ングしてる。Give your kind attention to our brother who has prepared this presentation to give to us tonight concerning the house of Israel. I know that he's spent a lot of time and a lot of preparation in this, so I do ask that you give him your kind attention, our brother Glenn Orsted.
Well, thank you, Ken. Good evening, everyone. It's good to see each of you here this evening. For those here this evening that might have been around at the time, you may well remember, but for some of the younger ones, such as myself, if you were alive at the end of November in 1947, you would awake in the morning to read the headlines of your newspaper that the United Nations had, in their General Assembly, voted to partition Palestine and to give the Jewish people a homeland. News that was received throughout much of the world, and with varying degrees of understanding and expectations, most of the various denominations of the Christian religions looked upon it as the fulfillment of prophecy. And yet, as time would prove, it wasn't truly the fulfillment, but rather the beginning of the fulfillment of prophecy. For there are indeed many scriptures that would refer to the gathering of the house of Israel back to their homelands. One such one that I just like to use strictly as a reference, I'm not going to use a whole lot of scriptures. It's in Ezekiel in the 36th chapter in the 24th verse. It says, "For I will take you from among the heathen and gather you out of all countries and will bring you into your own land." And from the beginnings of those events that happened in those months beginning in 1947, the effects of them have continued to be felt throughout the world and continue to be in the news and the headlines and in the political debates even today. And in our own beliefs, we have professed to believe in the gathering of Israel, and in sermons and in our Sunday school classes, in our discussions, you know, we've discussed many of the scriptures that would point to that. And so tonight I'm not going to concentrate on the scriptures that would talk of it, that would prophesy of it. But rather tonight I'm going to try to give a little bit of the historical events that transpired that made those prophetic scriptures become a reality and to become history. I hope that, I know some here weren't, but I hope at least a good portion of you were able to be here when our brother Ken Orr gave his presentation on the history of the Middle East, because I think he did an excellent job. In the short time that you had to give a presentation, there was a tremendous amount to cover, and I think he did an excellent job covering the various countries and the rise and falls of the governments and what transpired there. I'd like to sort of build on what he has started and concentrate not on the whole Middle East, but on those events that happened that allowed Israel to again be a nation. In my presentation this evening, I'm going to apologize in advance because I know a lot of these names, both the people and places, I am absolutely going to butcher. So if I happen to say a name and it's at least close to being recognizable and you know how to say it right, feel free to blurt it out, because a lot of these I'm going to have a lot of troubles with. But a few things we need to understand before I begin. And you don't need to turn to this. This is probably I'm not going to use any scriptures for quite a while. You don't need to turn to this one. But in the first chapters of Genesis, in the first chapters of the 12th, I'll get this right yet. In the first verses of the 12th chapter of Genesis, addressing Abraham, the Lord says, "Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation." And that's important for us to realize, because as we think of nations today and nationalities, they generally have characteristics that are particular to that group of people, either in appearance, habits, speech. Yet the house of Israel was a people taken out of a people because of a characteristic that the Lord saw that he could use. Probably for an example, if I could use one, I'm going to pick on someone I don't see here tonight so they won't feel bad. If our brother Jay Moser were to be picked out of this crowd for a special purpose, and that from his family and generations on would continue in that goal, but like his sister and his brother-in-law, Marlene and Ken, would be left out of it, and his brother and sister-in-law, Val and Mike Kelly, would be left out of it, and all of us who have known them, been friends with them for quite a while, would be left out of it. And though they'd be separate, at the same time, they'd come from a similar heritage and a similar ancestry and have some of the similar memories as time would continue on. And so, as the house of Israel is, it was taken out of a people, and yet they still have a common beginnings, if you will, or a memory or an ancestry into the same areas and the same lands and the same things they think back on when they think back to their ancestries. And out of those groups of people there from the house of Israel and Judaism, later on, as our Lord and Savior would come among his people and present his gospel, and Christianity would spread throughout the area. And then later on, the Islamic faith would come out of that same area. We have congregated in that, right in that very densely populated section there of many countries and peoples. Three separate religions, and yet they all center in the same holy places in the holy city of Jerusalem, with Christianity looking back to their beginnings and the lands that their Lord and Savior looked upon. Judaism looking back in the same areas where the Temple of Solomon was, and the Islamic faith all looking back and seeing there within a very short distance of one another. And they converge with one another, and they interact with one another, and they have a knowledge of one another. If I were to take an example of that today, it'd be much like as we would travel to Missouri into Independence, and there at the temple lot we would have the Church of Christ. Across the way, the reorganized church, and you look the other direction, and there would be the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We would believe, all coming from a looking back in our history, coming from a similar beginnings and having a similar background, yet beliefs that are very different, and yet we do have a knowledge of one another and somewhat more of an understanding of one another than many people on the outside would. And so Jerusalem is, with three religions centered in the area, interreacting with one another, knowledgeable of one another. And as if that doesn't make it confusing enough, many people of Hebrew birth become Christians. There are many Arabs that become Christians. And now you have someone such as an Arab with his Islamic faith and most of his family, and now with his Christian faith, he looks at the people of the house of Israel a little bit different. And the British that ruled over them between World War I and World War II, many of them were Jews by birth, many of them were Christians, and many of them in their time there would sympathize with the Arabs and their plight. And so the allegiances, the loyalties, and the friendships are sometimes quite confusing in the Middle East. Sometimes hard to tell exactly where someone's devotion would be. With those in mind, I'd like to start a little bit and give a little bit of a foundation about the house of Israel, starting with their dispersion. The curse of persecution had followed the Jews into every haven in which they had taken shelter during their dispersal. Burning in the ardor of their new faith to convert the pagan masses, the Catholic Church strove to emphasize the differences between their religion and its theological predecessor by forcing upon the Jews a kind of a spiritual apathy. The Emperor Theodosius II gave those aspirations legal force in his code, condemning Judaism and for the first time legally branding the Jews a people apart. Dagobert, the king of Franks, drove them from Gaul. Spain's Visigoths seized their children as converts. The Byzantine emperor Heraclius forbade Jewish worship. With the Crusades, spiritual apathy became a systematic slaughter as the Crusaders fell upon every hapless Jewish community on their route to Jerusalem. Most countries barred Jews from owning land. The religiously organized medieval craft and commerce guilds were closed to them. The church forbade Jews to employ Christians and for Christians to live among Jews. Perhaps most loathsome of all was the decision by the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, which was to stamp the Jews as a race apart by forcing them to wear a distinguishing badge. In England, it was a replica of the tablets on which Moses received the Ten Commandments. In France and Germany, it was a yellow O, the forerunner of the yellow stars with which the Third Reich would one day mark the victims of its gas chambers. Edward I of England and later Philip the Fair of France expelled the Jews from their nations, seizing their property before evicting them. And even the Black Death was blamed on the Jews, with over 200 Jewish communities being exterminated in the slaughters that were stirred by that wild fantasy. During those dark centuries, the only example of normal Jewish existence in the West was in the Spain of Caliphate, where under Arab rule, the Jewish people flourished as they never would again in the diaspora. The Christian Reconquista ended that, and in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella expelled the Jews from Spain. In Germany, Jews were forbidden to ride in carriages and were made to pay a special toll as they entered a city. The Republic of Venice enriched the vocabulary of the world with the word ghetto, from the quarter Ghetto Nouville, New Foundry, to which the Republic restricted its Jews. In Poland, the Cossack Revolt, with a ferocity and a devotion to torture unparalleled in Jewish existence, wiped out over 100,000 Jews in less than a decade. When the Tsars pushed their frontier westward across Poland, an era of darkness set in for almost half the world's Jewish population. Fenced into history's greatest ghetto, the Pale of Settlement, Jews were conscripted at the age of 12 to 25 years of military service and forced to pay special taxes on kosher meats and Sabbath candles. Jewish women were not allowed to live in the big city university centers without the yellow ticket of a prostitute. In 1880, after the assassination of Alexander II, the mobs, aided by the Tsar's soldiers, burned and butchered their way through one Jewish community after another. These were the bloody milestones of continuing slaughters and persecutions of the Jewish people throughout the centuries, which would become the constant of their history until the climax of the 6 million that would be killed in Hitler's gas chambers. And yet through those generations, men with neither the interest nor the intent nor even the remotest possibility of ever gazing on Judea's hills had nonetheless solemnly pledged to each other at the end of their Passover feast next year in Jerusalem. In 1894, a Jewish artillery captain in the French army was found guilty by a court-martial of treason. He was sentenced to life in prison and was transported to Devil's Island. After many years of debate in 1906, the charges would eventually be cleared against him and he would be reinstated in the French army as a major. But during the proceedings would arise a storm of anti-Jewish propaganda unleashed by the powerful anti-Semitic forces at the time. And in January of 1895, an angry mob had gathered on the esplanade of the Camp de Mars for the ceremony of removing Captain Alfred Dreyfus from his position and rank in the army. In that crowd was a Viennese newspaper man named Theodor Herzl. Like Dreyfus, Herzl was a Jew. And suddenly the crowd around him began to cry, "Kill the traitor, kill the Jew." Herzl suddenly realized that the officer's innocence or guilt was irrelevant to the crowd. They wanted blood. They wanted Jewish blood. As Theodor Herzl fled the crowd, he realized that the only way that the Jewish people could live safely was in a state of their own. And he vowed to make the realization of that Jewish state his life's work. His first project was the production of his blueprint for that state, a 100-page pamphlet entitled Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state. 2 years later, Herzl formally launched his movement with the First World Zionist Congress. The delegates of Herzl's Congress elected an international Jewish executive to guide the movement, created a Jewish national fund and a land bank to begin buying land in the area which they hoped to create this state, Palestine. At no time had Jewish life wholly disappeared in Palestine, to which Herzl's followers proposed to return. Even in the darkest hours of the dispersion, some colonies of Jews had survived in Safed, Tiberias, and Galilee. As elsewhere, their cruelest sufferings had come under Christian rule. The early Christians had banned them from Jerusalem. The Crusaders had burned the holy city's Jews alive in their synagogues. Palestine's Muslim rulers had been more tolerant. The Caliph Omar had left them relatively unmolested. Saladin had brought them back to Jerusalem along with his Muslim faithful. And under the Ottoman Turks, they had been able to take the first steps towards a return to the Promised Land. By that winter day in 1895, 30,000 of Jerusalem's 50,000 inhabitants were already Jewish. A series of pogroms in Russia just after the turn of the century would send a new wave of immigrants to Palestine. They represented the fruit of the first decade of Herzl's movement. But other than that immigration from Russia, there had been very little activity with the Jews entering Palestine. With the First World War drawing to a close, and Great Britain desiring to be placed in authority over the Middle East by the League of Nations, with their primary desire being to ensure an access to the abundant petroleum reserves that were believed to be there, they felt that there would be no problem with supporting the desire for a Jewish state and thus getting the Jewish support for their desired role in the area. And thus they issued the Balfour Declaration, which stated that His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The declaration also stated to ensure that they would have the Arab support, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. The British thereby thought that they had kept both interests happy and would have the support of both. Since there had been very little immigration into Palestine, they felt that they could surely handle a few coming in and work them in without any major incident. And for quite a while, beginning into the 1920s, that logic proved to be successful, with only a trickle of immigration continuing to come in. However, during the 1930s, with the increase of persecution of Jews in Poland and Nazi Germany, the numbers began to grow rapidly, reaching a peak of 60,000 between 1935 and 1936. the arriving Jews, anxious to promote a Hebrew language and a cultural revival, they maintained their own highly effective school system. Through the Jewish Agency for Palestine, they managed their own affairs independent of the Arabs. There was a tendency for the Jewish community in Palestine to act as a separate entity and with its higher standard of living and education to regard the Arabs as inferior. As a result, hostilities were already arising, and a major revolt by the Arabs in 1936 would force the British to take action. In order to stay within their original claims, they would still allow Jewish immigration to Palestine, but now they would place quotas on it so that they could be, as they thought, eased in with a minimal amount of friction. The extras would be placed in camps until space was available for them. This action only infuriated both sides. The Jews felt that they were being betrayed and being prevented from their homeland, which they felt that the British claimed to support. The Arabs were outraged that the British were even allowing any at all in, feeling there were already too many Jews allowed in Palestine. Following the Nazi Holocaust that exterminated 6 million Jews during World War II, the British were overwhelmed with the numbers that poured into Palestine. The British now had over 100,000 soldiers in the area already and were still unable to maintain it. Faced with trying to rebuild their own country after the war, unable to resolve the problems in Palestine, Britain announced that they would be withdrawing from the region and place the problem before the newly formed United Nations. Very shortly afterwards, the Jews in the autumn of 1947 demanded that the United Nations establish a Jewish homeland. The United Nations recognition for their right to such a state seemed to the Jews to be no more than reparation for the sufferings that the world had inflicted upon them. The proposed plan presented by the United Nations Special Committee on was a mapmaker's nightmare, and at best it was a compromise, and at worst it was an abomination. It would give 57% of Palestine to the Jewish people, despite the fact that 2/3 of its population was Arab, and that the majority of the land that they would give to the new Jewish state was already owned by Arab interests. It refused sovereignty of Jerusalem to either state, Jew or Arab, despite the fact that 2/3 of Jerusalem's population was Jewish, and that 1/6 of the entire Jewish population of Palestine was in Jerusalem. Quoting world interest in Jerusalem because of the religious ties of three of the world's largest religious beliefs, Judaism, Christianity, and the Islamic, the committee felt that the attachment of Jerusalem was too widely spread and deeply felt. Its potential for prompting strife was too great to entrust to one nation's care. The United Nations Special Committee on Palestine recommended that the city and its suburbs be placed under an international trusteeship. Despite the occasional disputes that might arise, for the most part, there had been good relations prior to this between the Arabs and the Jews of Palestine, especially within the walls of the old city in Jerusalem. The Islamic respect for men of religion had naturally been extended to their neighbors, and many were tied together by the most natural of bonds, poverty. On Friday evenings, the Arab youngsters would go to the homes of their devout Jewish friends and kindle for them the oil lamps that a Jew could not light on the Sabbath. Many an Arab and a Jewish youngster would always remember the exchange of gifts traditionally performed between the communities at feast times. The Jews bringing to their Arab neighbors heaps of cut dried almonds at the Sukkot, the harvest festival. Arabs offering trays of bread and honey to help their Jewish neighbors mark the end of Passover. The UN proposal, however, would immediately cause a division with people falling in on one side or the other. For the Arabs, and above all for the 1.2 million Arabs of Palestine, the partitioning of the land in which they had been a majority for 7 centuries seemed a monstrous injustice thrust upon them by the white Western imperialism in the expiation of a crime that they had not committed. With few exceptions, the Jewish people had dwelt in relative security among the Arabs over the centuries. The golden age of the diaspora had come in Spain and with the caliphs, and the Ottoman Turks had welcomed the Jews when the doors of much of Europe had been closed to them. The ghastly chain of crimes perpetrated on the Jewish people, culminating in the crematoriums of Germany, had been inflicted on them by the Christian nations of Europe, not those of the Islamic East. And it was on those nations, not theirs, the Arabs maintained, that the burden of those sins should fall. They felt as though the criminal was pronouncing judgment on an innocent party to pay restitution to the victim for his crime. The Jews were not very pleased with the proposal either. For almost 2,000 years, they had dreamed of a state of their own in which Jerusalem was the capital. And now it appeared that Jerusalem, although under UN protection, would be completely surrounded by land given to the Arabs. They would have to depend on foreign interests to protect the Jews in Jerusalem, defeating the very reason that they desired their own sovereignty. But it became apparent that the internationalization of Jerusalem was the price that would be paid for the birth of a Jewish nation. Urged by the Vatican, the Catholic nations of Latin America made it clear to the Jews that the price of their votes for the plan to partition Palestine would be the internationalization of Jerusalem. Without those votes, the Jews had no hopes of mustering the ballast that they needed to pass the partition plan. It was with a heavy heart, but they yielded and voiced acceptance of the plan. Jerusalem's loss was the measure of the price they were willing to pay for a Jewish state. The Arab League flatly rejected the UN proposal and made it known that if the plan for partition went before the General Assembly of the United Nations for voting and was passed, the Arabs of Palestine, supported by the Arab states, would go to war against this decision as soon as the British forces stationed there had left. None of the nations supporting the partition as a solution to the Palestine dilemma had been as forceful in its advocacy as the United States. Feeling the intense pressure from the most numerous and the most influential Jewish community in the world, America's lawmakers had let burst a flood tide of petitions, declarations, and statements in favor of partition and the unrestricted immigration of displaced Jews into Palestine. On Wednesday, November 26th, 1947, the date originally set for the General Assembly vote, it was not sure if there would be the necessary two-thirds majority needed to pass the measure that was before them. To offset the votes of the Arab Muslim nations alone would require 22 votes, more than one-third of the 57 member nations of the General Assembly. For each additional vote against partition, two would be needed in favor. The U.S. delegate and the representatives of the Jewish agency decided they would have to stall. They used a filibuster to delay the vote until adjournment. Because of the Thanksgiving recess the next day, it didn't give them an extra night of time, but it gave them 2 days until the assembly would convene again on Saturday, November 29th. During that time, to make sure that France voted in favor as they had promised, they were threatened with a cut of U.S. aid to rebuild their war-torn nation if they changed their vote. The president of the Philippines received a similar promise if his nation did not switch their nay to a yay vote. Threatened by a Jewish boycott of their product, the Firestone Rubber Company informed the president of Liberia that if his country did not vote in favor, they would reconsider plans to expand its rubber acreage there. Haiti and Greece were among some of the other nations that would find themselves receiving the sound advice of the United States and how they should vote. Most of the world would be listening to their radios intently that Saturday as the vote of each nation was read. When it was all done, the General Assembly of the United Nations had voted to partition Palestine by a vote of 33 in favor, 13 against, and 10 abstentions. As the vote was announced, Gabriel Catul would express the thoughts of most of his fellow Arabs. "The whole world has conspired to defeat us." Syria's United Nations delegate prophesied that the holy places are going to pass through long years of war, and peace will not prevail there for generations. The British announced that they were washing their hands of the situation, that they would remain in Palestine until May 15th, giving the United Nations time to implement their plan. After May 15th, Great Britain assumed no responsibility. As the Jews of Jerusalem danced in the streets across Palestine, Arabs were already planning to bring an end to that celebration. Within 24 hours of the vote, violence had already erupted throughout the Arab world. The United States embassies took the brunt of the protests, along with those of the French and the Syrian Communist Party headquarters, which was burned to the ground for Russia's supporting vote. Crowds smashed their way through the Arabian American Oil Company, and only a last-minute effort by police saved two American professors from a lynching at the hands of an angry mob. In Jerusalem, Arab shopkeepers and merchants shuttered their shops and marked them with a crescent so that the mob, which they knew was coming, would leave their place unharmed. It was the result of a three-day general strike called for by the Mufti of Jerusalem, their religious leader. The Arab crowd, its volatile emotions fired by the rumors deliberately spread on such occasions, this one claiming that two Arab women had been raped by Jews at Jaffa Gate, quickly escaped control. Yelling their slogans in a rhythmic Arabic sing-song, orchestrated by hand-clapping cheerleaders, cheerleading, the mob drove forward, waving force of clubs and iron bars. One unlucky Jewish journalist caught in its route, Asher Lazar, was dragged from his car and badly wounded. The mob then swung into a sprawling marketplace full of Jewish shops called the Commercial Center, clubbing its terrified Jewish shopkeepers, smashing windows, ripping doors from hinges. The rioters plunged into its stores, tearing goods from the shelves by the armful. Kids scampered into the confectionery shops, stuffing their mouths and their pockets with sticky wads of candy and challah. Adults tossed the cheap merchandise aside to reach for the best goods that they could find. Bolts of cloth, hats, bedspreads, shoes, cases of canned food. With the shops now half looted, the burning began. Before long, tight black spirals of smoke would be drifting over every section of the quarter, sending a mist of ashes over the new city of Jerusalem. A few of the area's Arab residents tried to check the damage. Samuel Balsan put out a fire in the store below his apartment, and then he went off and discreetly painted a crescent on the few shops left undamaged by the mob. They belonged to his Jewish friends. Soon, most of the whole quarter, both in Old Jerusalem and New, was ablaze. The violence would be of no surprise to the Jews of Palestine. They had known that their state could not be created by a vote or a piece of paper, that it would have to be purchased with blood, with their blood. For quite some time, they had been trying to build an arms supply despite the British rule that would prohibit them bringing arms into Palestine. For 3 years, Yehuda Ariza had been smuggling arms and ammunition into Palestine by welding them inside of tractors, road rollers, and other equipment. And by November of 1947, he had managed to smuggle in 3,000 rifles, 226 machine guns, 10,000 hand grenades, 3 million cartridges of ammunition, hundreds of mortar shells, and his proudest achievement, 3 small airplanes. In the summer of 1945, Heinz Slavin read an article in a newspaper that the United States was to begin selling their machinery from their armament industry built during the war. They were to be disassembled so as not to be used by anyone and sold for their scrap value. Slavin was quickly in New York and buying scrap machine parts, a vast task that he would have to hunt for the entire country for matching parts to build a complete machine, and then he needed an entire factory. Slowly, in an abandoned dairy farm at 2000 Park Avenue, the machinery to mount a daily production of 50,000 rifle or machine gun bullets, the machine tools needed to perform the 1,500 operations necessary for the assembly line production of a machine gun, the equipment to manufacture 81-millimeter mortar shells was put together. Bought by their weight for its scrap value, Slavin had purchased for $2 million, $70 million worth of equipment. Once the machinery was complete, assembled and checked to be sure that it was operational, Slavin then took upon the momentous task of classifying with a code that he invented the machinery into 75,000 separate pieces, which were then disassembled, reassembled, mismatched, and put back together so that no one could possibly recognize them for what their real intent was. In this condition, they were then shipped to Palestine, where they then were reassembled and hidden throughout the Jewish villages throughout Palestine under the watchful eyes of both the British and the Arabs. Long before the vote for partition, the Jews of Palestine had begun to organize their underground military, which would one day evolve to be their army, and that would evolve to be their army along with their statehood. It was to be known as the Haganah, and from its creation, accepted women on an equal basis with men. Primarily due to the numerical superiority of the Arabs, its training centers were in the basements of the Jewish institutions, usually schools or trade unions. Protected by a tier of guards, members met once a week to practice judo, to learn to break down weapons, climb ropes, burst into houses, jump from moving cars, always ready at the hint of a British raid to convert themselves into a studious school children or card-playing workers. Then they served in an apprenticeship, carrying messages or tracking the movements of key Arab or British figures. Finally, they began field training 2 or 3 days a month, usually in some remote wadi reached by a punishing march under the grueling hot sun, where the waste of the desert might muffle the crack of a rifle shot. Oranges and potatoes stuffed with detonators would serve as dummy hand grenades. So desperately short was ammunition that the most solemn moment in a recruit's rifle course came when he was given a single round to fire as a kind of graduation present. In the summer, disguised as extra field hands, Haganah units were sent to kibbutzim for 2 weeks or a month's advanced training. Guerrilla tactics and night fighting that the Arabs loathed became their specialties. The Haganah command even managed to install, despite the British surveillance, a 2-month officer's course, processing 150 men at a time at an experimental agricultural station in the Valley of Jezreel. By sharp contrast, the armed bands of the Mufti seemed to spend as much time searching abandoned homes for liquor as they did on guard. A leaping cat, an unusual noise, a probing shot from a Jewish post usually was enough to unleash a wild burst of their fire, terrifying with indiscriminate equality their fellow Arabs as well as their Jewish neighbors. Those wild bursts of gunfire expressed to a certain degree the mentality of the Arab villagers. For them, the possession of a firearm was a sure proof of its owner's masculinity as his first male heir. Part weapon, part plaything, it was used to mark weddings, funerals, and the village feasts with a capoeous barrage of noise and lead. And from that upbringing came a natural familiarity with arms, but a tendency to fire off ammunition recklessly that was markedly different from the habits inculcated in their Jewish foes, to whom each cartridge was a minor treasure. Much of that same attitude was to be found within the Arab leaders that felt sure that the numbers of their people would guarantee a victory with no real thought to the method or the organization of such an effort. In fact, since the middle of the 1930s, anyone that might think or otherwise speak out as such were systematically being eliminated by Haj Amin Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem. He had early in his office made it a practice of eliminating anyone he thought to be suspicious or a threat to his position. Landowners, school teachers, and government officials, clerks, at times anyone accused of reading and writing English too well, all were gunned down. Over 2,000 people died in that vicious intramural bloodletting. While the Jews of Palestine were developing the young leaders and the social institutions that would be their greatest resource, Haj Amin Husseini methodically deprived the Arabs of theirs. Throttling progress and any drift to rational thought with his angry fanaticism, cowing with the guns of his ignorant villagers the educated elite, he reduced a generation of Arab leadership to fear and silence. Debased by overuse and having lost much of its spiritual appeal, nonetheless, as the call for the holy war rang out through the Islamic world, it still stirred the emotions of the Arabs. While the cry for the holy war was in the streets, in Cairo, the Arab League met to plan their collective actions. And in Tel Aviv, the leaders of the Jewish agency in the Haganah met to plan theirs. The British had already decided theirs. Until the day they left on May 15, they would not become involved in any situation unless it grew to the point that it would be out of control and cost British lives. They flatly stated that during the transition between their mandate in Palestine and the United Nations takeover, they would not be responsible for law and order in Palestine. Already having lost many lives over their 30-year reign, and already 7 more killed since the vote on partition, they would act only in British interest and have nothing to do with partition in any way, shape, or form. Secretly, however, they had decided that in any actions taken, they would favor the Arabs. This was because they hoped to continue their presence in the area by being appointed by the United Nations as the governing body of the new International Jerusalem. With the United States already known to be Zionist supporters, and with Russia known to be anti-God, the British therefore felt that they would be the logical choice. At least so it would appear to the British. With Jerusalem completely surrounded by Arab-controlled land, the British felt it wisdom to maintain good relations and aid them in their new aspirations at this time, hoping that such would give them favoritism when they would take over their new control of Jerusalem, as they would hope later. In so doing, during their transition time, they would continue to put in place the restrictions on Jewish immigration and prohibiting their importing of arms. The focus of attention from both the Jews and Arabs was also on Jerusalem, because both sides knew that the fate of the new Jewish nation would hinge on the survival or the fall of that holy city and its many Jewish inhabitants. The Haganah were concerned on how they could maintain the city, being surrounded by Arabs and with only one road leading from the sea into it. That road was 45 miles long and went from the sea level to the 2,500-foot elevation of the holy city, and almost all of its length was in Arab-held territory and passed through several Arab villages on the way. Along its length were several sections winding through mountainous rocky valleys, perfect for ambushes and blockades. It was on this road that all knew the war for the Jewish state would be won or lost. Knowing that as soon as the British left, it would be all-out war, the Jews had already sent buyers to both the United States and Europe to begin buying as many arms as they could. Not wanting the risk of having them seized by the British, it was decided that they would be stockpiled in secret in their respective nations of purchase, and they would hope that when the British left, they could hold out until their arrival. Ironically, while most of the Arab people were being incited to war, in Cairo at the meeting of the Arab League, there would be little support for a war in Palestine. Egypt's prime minister did not want to place his country's forces in a conflict in which he felt would have little effect on Egypt regardless of the outcome, while he was currently trying to secure England's evacuation of the Suez Canal. King Abdullah of Transjordan secretly even welcomed the Jewish state, which he viewed as a return of one Semitic people persecuted in the West to aid another Semitic people whose development in their ancient homeland had been held back by a Western institution, colonialism. He had hoped that a strong Jewish state, if welcomed by the Arabs, would work together to rid the Middle East of the Western influence. He also hoped that he would be able to annex the section allocated to the Arabs in the partition plan into his own country, a move that he knew would meet resistance from his neighboring Arab countries, and he didn't want additional conflict on the other side from the new neighbors in the Jewish state. Saudi Arabia didn't want to jeopardize any of their oil revenues from the Western powers. And as complex and as varied as all their reasons may have been, even those at the Arab League who quite vocally opposed the new Jewish state, none were willing to commit their troops to such an action as war. After many days of debate, they were all willing to send supplies, arms, and money for the campaign, but no troops. This plan had a great deal of appeal to Haji Amin Husseini, the Mufti, who didn't want the Arab forces involved that might threaten his authority and his ambitions of being the ruler over all the Middle East. He was more than willing to accept their handouts to build his own army. The leaders at the Arab League knew well his ambitions and had no intentions of helping it, as it was the Mufti who was primarily responsible for agitating the people and creating their cry for blood. Not only that, but Husseini had worked closely with Hitler and his associates during World War II because he was promised the spoils of the Middle East, and they all knew that there would be an outcry from the whole world if they funded one of Hitler's friends in this bid against the Jews. Instead, they decided to supply a newly formed liberation army, which would be all volunteer. Those that desired to drive the Jews into the sea could do so, and they would supply the arms and the materials with which to do it. On December 15th, the Arabs succeeded in giving Jerusalem a hint of what was ahead for them when they blew up the water pipe bringing water to the city. The British managed to repair it because it was their water supply at the time also, but 90% of the city's water came from the springs of Ras El Ain, 60 miles to the west. The 18-inch pipe and the four pumping stations required to get the water up 3,000 feet to Jerusalem lay in Arab territory. Even the little additional water available in the city from one of its most ancient sources, King Solomon's Pools, lay in Arab-controlled territory. Once the British left, the Arabs could cripple Jewish Jerusalem and force its surrender without a shot by depriving the city of one of its most vital element of daily existence, water. A bundle of dynamite sticks would be all that was needed to do it. Throughout Jerusalem, they began to store water in cisterns that had been constructed there. By now, there was little in Jerusalem that would remind one of what daily life had been like before that day at the end of November. Even the one refuge in which Arab and Jew had always found harmony, the graveyard, was troubled in the first few weeks following the partition vote. Jewish funeral processions winding their way up to the Mount of Olives, some behind the coffins of the first victims of the sporadic shooting ringing out in the city, often came under Arab sniper fire. More than any other facet of its daily existence, however, a ritual accomplished each evening at the Egged bus station on the outskirts of town had become the symbol of Jewish life in Jerusalem. The struggle for the roads, foreseen by the chiefs of the Haganah and by the Arabs alike, had begun. The Arab ambushes were still sporadic and unorganized, but they had already forced the Haganah to rely on daily convoys to link Jerusalem to the coast. The steel-plated buses used in the convoys weighed 8 tons each, empty. They could go no faster than 10 miles an hour climbing up to Jerusalem from Bel Awal, and rare was the convoy that escaped without being at least sniped at. Long before sunset each night, the crowds would begin to gather in the bus station, waiting for the incoming convoy to arrive. As its vehicles ground to a halt, the crowd swarmed over them, every eye locked on their doors, waiting for the results of a sinister lottery. The first figures to appear in those doorways were often covered with blood, candidates for the ambulance that awaited each convoy. The last were sometimes dead, laid out on the bus station's asphalt apron to be identified by the pathetic scream of the friend or relative who'd come to the station to welcome them back to Jerusalem. Life throughout Palestine was becoming a complete state of confusion. As Abdul Qader Husseini drove through the chaotic streets, he looked forward to the day when it would all be under his careful eye. Cousin of Haj Amin Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Abdul Husseini had been sent to lead the holy war strugglers in their bid. As he contemplated his plans, he drove to Katamun. There was a pleasant little three-story building called the Hotel Semiramis. Run by an Arab family, it had a discreet, quiet little sitting room where he'd like to come and relax and gather his thoughts. With the task ahead of him, he found it especially refreshing today. Often he would be there for hours, quietly sitting. The Haganah were already developing an extensive intelligence gathering network, with informants planted in many Arab and British institutions. With the passage of time, the accomplishment of those varied intelligent units would grow to impressive dimensions. Already, the flow of information was highly significant. It included the weekly intelligence estimate of the British Army for the Middle East, most exchanged between Sir Alan Cunningham and his superiors in London, the orders and the circulars sent to the subordinate commands of GHQ Palestine, and the British Army's periodic evaluation of the state of the Jewish and Arab preparations. More vital for the future was the penetration established by Jewish intelligence inside the Arab ranks. Within a fortnight of each meeting of the Arab League, a copy of its minutes was in the hands of the Jewish agency in Jerusalem. Even the Cairo headquarters of Haj Amin Husseini had been penetrated with a paid informer. In the basement of the Jewish agency, in two closely guarded rooms, was organized what would become the most precious source of information of all. Those two rooms were linked by a special cable to the central switchboard of the Jerusalem Post Office. There, the post, telephone, and telegraph's largely Jewish technicians were quietly setting taps on key Arab and British telephones in Jerusalem and on the trunk lines linking Palestine to Europe and the rest of the Middle East. Soon there would be scores of operators on duty around the clock in the basement hideaway, carefully transcribing the conversations of every key Arab and British official in the city. Their own radio messages were sent by a transmitter hidden in a private home. To fool the British detection services, it was located in a neighborhood without electric current. Current was supplied by a wire stretched from house to house from a nearby hospital. The Haganah's order for its concealment was, hang out more undershirts. The housewives along its route had all been asked to keep it covered with laundry. Despite their tremendous progress in gathering information, they still could make mistakes. The situation was deteriorating throughout Palestine, and many Jews were leaving the outlying areas to move into the cities. It was decided to take a decisive strike and that it would be necessary to boost the Jewish morale. They would have to attack one of the key Arab headquarters in Katamun. Their information suggested two possibilities. The first was a little boarding house called Claridge's. The other was the Hotel Semiramis, at which Abdul Qader Husseini's jeep had been seen the day before for over an hour. Kay Albina was awakened by the sound and the flash of the explosion. As she looked out her bedroom window, it seemed that the roof of the hotel lifted slowly up into the air and then dropped back to the earth. A first aid student, Kay Albina, swept up her Red Cross kit and a handful of sheets and rushed through the rain-swept streets to help the wounded. None of her first aid manuals, however, had prepared her for the horror of that first sight she saw on the ruins of the hotel. It was the figure of a woman stumbling hysterically through the rubble, cradling in her arms a severed head of her infant child. 26 people died in the explosion of the Samaritan's Hotel. Sammy Abusuan and Guida Cordoas survived, but the Abusuan family was virtually obliterated. Sammy's mother, his father, his two aunts, his three uncles died. Herbert Lorenzo, the 23-year-old proprietor, died along with his parents. It would be a costly mistake for the Haganah. The Mufti had already been trying to convince the Arab villagers to join in the fight, as none would be safe from the ravages of the Jews, who he claimed wished to destroy every Arab in their path to statehood. Many Arabs had chosen to remain neutral in the security of their homes, not desiring to take sides or believe the wild stories that were being told. But suddenly, with the attack on the hotel and the destruction of a whole family, all innocent people, the stories became believable, and the numbers of the Jewish people's Arab foes suddenly increased. It was becoming increasingly more difficult to supply Jerusalem. In Jewish Jerusalem, food was beginning to disappear. Milk, eggs, meat, vegetables were in short supply. The winter was bitter cold, and in most Jewish homes, fuel was desperately short. Even more serious for the city's housewives was the shortage of kerosene for cooking. The most elegant among them began to carry a pail or a tin can when they went out, in case a donkey-toed kerosene tanker should cross their route. Little mail was delivered, cable communications were chaotic, and international telephone calls were held up for hours and sometimes days. Jewish lawyers refused to attend court because their safety was not assured. The court system ground to a standstill. The district health office ceased registering deaths, births, and contagious diseases at the beginning of the year. The cemetery on the Mount of Olives was now inaccessible to Jerusalem's Jewish population. Covered with sheets and laid out on litters, their dead were borne off instead to the burial grounds of Sanhedria, where their ancestors had laid the judges of an earlier Israel to rest. On New Year's Eve, the Arabs set up a massive roadblock at Jaffa Gate, cutting off the flow of supplies from New Jerusalem into the walls of the Jewish quarter of the Old City. The quarter's residents began to endure the modern form of one of the oldest traditions of the ancient city they so esteemed, the siege. Not an ounce of food, fuel, or ammunition had reached the quarter since the Arabs erected their roadblock. The unburied dead accumulated in a week of the blockade lay just beyond the Haganah's headquarters. Kerosene used by the quarter's residents for cooking was almost gone. So, too, was milk for the children. Trying to send the supplies on the single road to Jerusalem was an ordeal, a brutal, desperate struggle to claw one more load of goods past Abdul Kader's increasingly effective ambushes. The survival of the 100,000 Jews in the city of David depended on the Haganah's ability to force 30 trucks a day up the gorge of Bel Abwad to Jerusalem. 30 trucks, yet as each week passed, the daily average fell under the pressure of Abdul Kader's attacks. The convoys were protected by boys and girls. The eldest, at this time, Ruvan Tamar, was the convoy leader. He had just turned 20. The road to Jerusalem was littered with burned-out vehicles, scorched by Molotov cocktails, torn apart by mines, looted of every movable part. These stark metallic skeletons were the constant reminder of the price that the Haganah was paying for supplying Jerusalem. To the kids guarding the convoy, each blackened wreck was a memorial to some friend whose youth had ended there in the gulch of Bel Abwad. Jerusalem's Arab population, living in a city surrounded by Arab countryside, suffered none of the food and the fuel shortages plaguing the Jewish neighbors. However, as the streams of gangs flowed into Jerusalem from Syria, Transjordan, and Iraq, it would sometimes be difficult to determine whose side they had come to fight. They would squabble constantly. They extorted extortion money from the citizens that they were hired to defend, ostensibly there to defend the holy city. They were often as anxious to pillage it as they were to fight for it. Untrained and undisciplined, they would respond to a few random Jewish sniper shots with a wild barrage of rifle fire, and then spend hours searching the socks for ammunition to replace the rounds that they had wasted. Jerusalem, the city's Lebanese council noted with despair in a dispatch to his foreign office, is subject to a disorder unequaled anywhere in the world. Arms of every kind are passed from hand to hand under the eyes of the authority. Public life is practically paralyzed. Stores and markets close at noon. The Arab bands have one chief here and another there, all acting independently without any contact between them. The tempo of the Arab assaults on the road to Jerusalem was increasing daily. There had arisen considerable pressure to evacuate Jerusalem's women and children to the coast while they could escape. There are sound reasons for doing it. Their evacuation would make the food and the water problem immensely easier. The decision not to let them go was Joseph's alone. He took it because he reasoned that the fighting spirit of Jerusalem's men would be raised if they knew that their homes and families lay helpless just behind them. Those men would have no illusions about their family's fate if the city was overrun. The pain of that decision and the awareness of the terrible moral burden that it would be if Jerusalem fell would weigh on Joseph for months to come. But as he would remark years later in recalling that decision, he would say, "We did not favor the easy way." 6,000 miles and a world away, another group of men wrestled too with the problems of Jerusalem. They labored in the standardized dreariness of the committee rooms of the United Nations, and the problem before them was represented by an object as banal as a calendar. While Dove Joseph was deciding whether to evacuate the Jewish women and children from his city, the members of the United Nations Working Committee on Jerusalem agonized over the fact that if the official holidays of all the religious communities and national bodies represented in Jerusalem were to be honored as such, the holidays of the little international city they were planning would exceed the number of days on the calendar. The preoccupation was indicative of the trivialities on which the United Nations planning for the international Jerusalem had slid. For 6 weeks, while the situation in the city deteriorated daily, the members of the United Nations Working Committee on Jerusalem had argued their way paragraph by paragraph through the legal charter with which they would order the birth of the world's first international city. They extended its limits to include Bethlehem and three Arab communities so that its populations would be made up of equal number of Arabs and Jews. It was to be divided into three boroughs, one for the Arabs, one for the Jews, and one made up of the old walled city at the heart of it all for the world. It would be demilitarized and run by the United Nations appointed governor, aided by his elected legislative staff. Justice would be administered by a court system complex enough to bewilder Jerusalem's most abstract theologians. Things were not transpiring nearly as well as the Haganah had hoped. They had planned to stockpile arms during the transition between the British and the United Nations takeover and then hold out until they could arrive. They had not counted on the British indifference to their plight. They had already almost completely exhausted their arsenal, which they had smuggled in past the British. By the time the British would leave, there would be nothing left with which to hold out with. The repeated pleas for the British to help get the convoys to Jerusalem had fallen on deaf or at least uncaring ears. The British had determined that an open road was constituted if they could drive on it unharassed. So once each morning, just after sunrise, a British patrol would leave Tel Aviv to drive to Jerusalem and then return. The trip would then be repeated that evening just before sunset. If the trips were completed without incident, the British were content that the road was open and did not feel compelled to take any other action. The Arabs along that route tried to their best abilities to make sure that those trips were pleasant ones for the British soldiers, to the point of including to help them to change a flat tire if it need be. The Haganah decided to risk some of their equipment already smuggled in to try and produce ammunition. They were able to secretly produce 9mm bullets, but they were unable to produce the cartridge casings necessary for them. When someone realized that an English firm produced women's lipstick in which the lipstick tube was the same caliber they needed, suddenly the Jewish women of Palestine in the middle of a war would have the vanity to purchase 3 million lipsticks in 5 months. They would prove to be quite ingenious in their shortages. Having obtained their first armored car, the Haganah knew well that one would have no effect on the forces they faced, but if used properly, it could have a tremendous psychological effect. And so the little armored car would be driven about a village, ensuring that it was seen by Arabs, and then would disappear into a building where it would be disassembled, loaded into trucks and cars, driven to another village, reassembled, driven around to be seen, and then the process would be repeated over and over again until the little phantom armored car had the Arabs convinced that the Jews had a whole fleet of armored cars. As the leaders of the Jewish agency met with the Haganah leaders, they faced a grim reality. They were exhausting their arms already, and when the British left, they would be faced with tanks, artillery, and planes with which they never did have anything to defend themselves, and their funds were depleted. It was decided that someone would have to go to America to raise funds. As they discussed it, a woman's voice volunteered itself. Against much opposition, she stated that the men before her were needed to fight the war, about which she knew nothing, but this thing she could do. So not even taking time to return home to pack, she boarded a plane and landed in New York on a bitter winter's night, wearing only a thin spring dress and with only $10 in her pocketbook. 2 days later, trembling on a podium in Chicago, she found herself facing a distinguished gathering of leaders of the Council of Jewish Federations, drawn from the 48 states of the Union. Their meeting and her arrival in the United States had been a fortuitous coincidence. Before her, in one Chicago hotel room, were most of the financial leaders of the American Jewish community, the very men whose aid she had been sent to seek. Her task would not be easy. Its members were already under great pressure for funds from their American institutions, for hospitals, synagogues, cultural centers. They were weary of the appeals from abroad for money. Despite the speaker's list being drawn up long in advance, she convinced them to allow her to address the group. "You must believe me," she said, "when I tell you that I have not come to the United States solely to prevent 700,000 Jews from being wiped off the face of the earth. During these last years, the Jewish people have lost 6 million of their kind, and it would be presumptuous indeed of us to remind the Jews of the world that 700,000 Jews are in danger. That is not the question. If, however, these 700,000 Jews survive, then the Jews of the world will survive with them, and their freedom will be forever assured. But if they did not," she said, "then there is little doubt that for the centuries there will be no Jewish people, there will be no Jewish nation, and all our hopes will be smashed. In a few months," she told the audience, "a Jewish state will exist in Palestine. We shall fight for its birth. That is natural. We shall pay for it with our blood. That is normal. The best among us will fall. That is certain. But what is equally certain is that our morale will never waver, no matter how numerous our invaders may be." Yet she warned those invaders would come with cannon and armor. "Against those weapons, sooner or later, our courage will have no meaning, for we will cease to exist," she said. She had come, she announced, to ask the Jews of America for $25 to $30 million to buy the heavy arms that they would need to face the invaders' cannon. "My friend," she said in making her plea, "we live in a very brief present. When I tell you that we need this money immediately, it does not mean next month or in 2 months. It means right now. It is not you," she concluded, "to decide whether we shall continue our struggle or not. We shall fight. The Jewish community of Palestine will never hang out the white flag before the Mufti of Jerusalem. But you can decide one thing, whether the victory will be ours or the Mufti's." A hush had fallen on her audience, and for an instant she thought that she had failed. Then suddenly the entire assembly of men and women rose in a deafening wave of applause. While its echoes still rang out through the dining room, the first volunteers scrambled to the platform with their pledges. Before coffee was served, she had already been promised over $1 million. They were made available in cash immediately, a fact without precedent. Men began to telephone their bankers and secure personal loans against their own names for the sums that they estimated they would be able to raise later in their communities. Astounded by her Chicago triumph, she set off on her cross-country tour, setting a grueling pace, speaking sometimes 3 and 4 times a day. Only once in her extraordinary pilgrimage did she falter. It was in Palm Beach, Florida. Looking at the elegance of the dinner crowd before her, their jewels, their furs, the moon playing on the sea beyond the banquet hall's windows, she suddenly thought of her soldiers of the Haganah trembling in the cold of the Judean hills that night. Thinking of the contrast between that scene and the one before her, tears came to her eyes. "These people don't want to hear about the fighting and the death in Palestine," she thought, but they did. And so movingly that before the evening was over, the gathering at Palm Beach had pledged her $1.5 million. The woman who had arrived in New York one bitter January night with $10 in her pocketbook would leave with $50 million. Waiting for the airplane that she returned on was David Ben-Gurion. As Golda Meir stepped off the plane, he would state, "The day when history is written, it will be recorded that it was thanks to a Jewish woman that the Jewish state was born." Ehud Avriel, who had been in Europe buying arms for his new Jewish state, so far had managed to purchase 25,000 rifles, 5,000 Bren guns, 300 machine guns, and 50 million cartridges. Europe, after World War II, was an arms flea market. And now, with the funds available thanks to Golda Meir, he could begin shopping for tanks, airplanes, and field guns. And across the ocean in the United States, Exiel Federman was on a similar mission. As he wandered through the warehouses full of U.S. surplus, he passed a stack of U.S. Army pack racks designed to help men carry a heavy load. Passing by, he hesitated and then turned back to them. They might be some use, he thought, and they were only 20 cents. It would prove to be one of his most valuable purchases. World War II had proved the value of air power, but the Haganah were faced with the question of how do you build an underground air force in an occupied country. The answer came from Aaron Ramez, a 29-year-old RAF veteran. He had provided air cover for the Normandy landings, escorted bomber command flights over Germany, and attacked V-bomb sites. None of these experiences, however, had produced was produced a shock to revile the one that he had received on his return to Palestine. It came on the first sight of his father. He was behind the barbed wire of a British concentration camp, guarded by the men wearing the uniform of the country for which Ramez had risked his life. Embittered, Ramez drafted a 15-page memorandum. It was the proposal for the establishment of a Jewish Air Force. That document, four private pleasure planes and an air taxi, and 20 pilots, were the foundations of what would become two decades later the most proficient Air Force in the world. Ramez's memorandum had, in sense, answered the Haganov's question by ignoring it. "You don't build an underground air force in an occupied country," he wrote. "You build it outside while preparing inside the country the structures to receive it." So around the country, settlers set to work building 10 primitive dirt landing strips to receive the air services planes when they had them. Soon they had added to their numbers, hidden in the hangars of Europe and the U.S., three almost brand new Constellations, 15 C-46s, and 20 RAF Auster observation planes that were sold for scrap metal were cannibalized to yield 12 flyable planes. In Jerusalem, things continued to worsen but despite their adversities, the Jews of Palestine continued. On February 2, 1948, the Arabs succeeded in blowing up the Palestine Post, Zion's most articulate voice in the Middle East. While the dead and the injured were removed from the rubble, others searched for the carbons of the night stories. Another printing press had been located in a temporary newsroom set up in a nearby apartment. There, the reporters' girlfriends retyped the scraps that they were able to salvage. 6 o'clock the next morning, the paper was on the streets. It was a bedraggled, sad little sheet reduced to one page, but it proudly bore the logotype of the Palestine Post. The Post had not been silenced. That was to exemplify much of the dedication throughout Palestine. A few days later, that publication would have the unfortunate task of noting that four Haganah men had been arrested by the British Highland Light Infantry for exchanging gunfire with Arabs. An hour later, the four were handed over to an Arab mob. One of the four was fortunate. The mob killed him with a bullet. His three companions were stripped, emasculated, and then hacked to death. From that day on, every Haganah member was ordered to oppose with force any attempt of arrest or search by the British forces in the area. That, with yet another event a few days later, would push the breaking point of Jewish-British relations. February 21, 1948, a three-truck British Army convoy arrived in Zion Square. Driven by British soldiers that were sympathetic to the Arabs, they were led past the British checkpoints by the lead armored car. Each truck contained over a ton of TNT with a mixture of 200 pounds of potassium and aluminum powder to substantially raise the temperature of the explosion and send a spray of miniature Molotov cocktails through the damaged area. 54 people were killed in the explosion that morning. The bombing that Abdul Husseini thought would cause the Jews of Jerusalem to sue for peace only outraged them. In a fury aimed at the British for their recent participation in the Arab interests, within a few hours would leave 12 British officers dead. The British did something they had never done before. They ordered their troops to stay out of Jewish neighborhoods of Jerusalem, an act that would greatly help the efforts of the Haganah. As if the Jews had not already had enough major setbacks, they were about to come close to a major catastrophe. A driver for the United States consulate stopped at the gate of the Jewish agency to pick up two Jewish secretaries employed at the consulate. For some time, he had gained the Haganah's confidence by smuggling arms to them. The source of his arms supply, however, was his Arab associates. On this day, he secured a particularly large delivery and thought it would be wisdom if he were allowed inside the compound so that the transaction would not be seen. While the guard went inside to get his payment, the driver excused himself to go across the street to buy cigarettes. An alert guard that happened by saw the car in front of the Haganah headquarters, where its leaders were meeting to decide their next steps. The guard would release the handbrake and push the car across the courtyard. That action would cost the guard his life, but save the new Jewish state their leadership they so desperately needed. 13 people were killed by the explosion, all of them in the civilian wing of the agency. Scheduled to meet with a delegate from the United Nations 2.5 hours later, the two men would show up, one with his head completely bandaged except for four small slits in his eyes, nose, and mouth, the other with his torn and bloodstained shirt. Both were convinced that they had to convince the people of the world that they were capable of managing their country when the British left. So no mention was made of their appearance, or the disaster that had nearly taken both of their lives that morning. Instead, for an hour and a half, they talked of their dreams of the new state that they would build in Palestine in the next 20 years. Colonel Rasha Lund, the UN delegate, would remember thinking, "No one will be able to stop a people like yours." While the Haganah was busy planning how they could occupy the British institutions which had been selected for their strategic value the instant the British left, which would keep them in key control of central Jerusalem, in the United States there was growing concern over the violence in Palestine. There was growing concern that the United Nations partition plan would not be obtainable, and in the United States there was growing support for a trusteeship for all of Palestine instead of just Jerusalem. President Truman's advisors were almost at the point of fistfights over the debate of what to do in Palestine. To calm things, President Truman hinted that he might consider the trusteeship plan to calm its supporters, while not saying he had given up on the partition plan to calm its advocates. Later, Truman would meet with a man considered by many Jews to be the greatest Jew that ever lived, Chaim Weizhan. Weizhan convinced Truman of their ability to build their nation and convinced the president to continue the United States support of the partition plan. Not even 24 hours after Weizmann had left the White House, Warren Austin, the United States delegate of the United Nations, asked permission to address the body. The proponents of trusteeship had taken Truman's consideration to mean approval and now presented it to the world body. The Arabs were jubilant. The Jews were outraged by this betrayal from the one nation they thought was their true ally. President Truman was furious. He knew that it was a deliberate act to try and force him to play their hand. Loy Henderson, the author of Warren Austin's United Nations speech, was very shortly named to a new post, U.S. Minister to Kathmandu. All the supporters of the trusteeship felt the cutting edge of the president's wrath. Having publicly reversed its stand, the United States stand, the president couldn't reverse the United States opinion again for a while. The world would have to thank the U.S.-favored trusteeship. The president wrote a message himself and gave it to Judge Samuel Rosenman to deliver to Chaim Weizhan. The contents of that dispatch would only be known to those three until many years after all their deaths. The price that the Haganah was paying to get its convoys through was exorbitant. The amount of food reaching the city had dwindled to a trickle. Its reserves were disappearing. Unmentioned but increasingly present was a specter which now loomed over the Jewish city, hunger. The Arab ambushes had become more organized and a new twist added. Using the growing unrest among the civilians, the Arabs of the Mufti's force would blockade the road with rocks, trees, and mines, and then disable the convoy with gunfire and hand grenades and Molotov cocktails. By this time, the Arab villagers, aroused by the commotion, would come swarming over the hillside onto the trapped victims and swarm over them like locusts on a field, stripping them of everything they could. As the convoy grueled up the steep hill, ahead waited 300 men, hidden in the slopes above the barricade of stones and logs thrown in the middle of the road. The closest of them was 15 feet on either side of the roadway, waiting to spring on the leading cars with grenades if the landmines hidden in the roadblock failed to stop them. On each side of the road, a Vickers machine gun was trained on the barricade. The 40 trucks were strung out over a mile on the road. Crammed into those trucks were hundreds of sacks of flour, thousands of cans of meat, sardines, and margarine. And there was even one truck whose panels were spilling over with a fruit the people of Jerusalem had not seen in weeks, oranges. For the 100,000 Jerusalemites, those 40 truckloads of food represented more than a series of meager meals. Their safe arrival would be proof that the lifeline on which they depended, the road to the sea, was still theirs, that it could deliver to them the ingredients of their survival. At the lead of the convoy was the blockade runner. As it was at the head of each convoy, it was a truck with heavy steel plates welded to it for protection and a huge blade at the front to clear the road. The drivers and the crews of those vehicles would have the highest fatality rates of any vehicles in the convoys during those months. As the blockade runner positioned itself to clear the road, the unmistakable explosion told those behind it that it had hit one of the hidden landmines. The blockade runner lay on its side in the gully alongside the road. The second truck behind it hit a mine, sending it at a right angle to the axis of the roadway and blocking the road. The hail of gunfire poured out on the convoy, mixed with the sound of the exploding tires, was deafening as it bounced off the steel plating. The men hidden in the ditches along the sides rushed the stopped convoy with their hand grenades, forcing them to close the slits from which they saw and returned fire. It instantly became like an oven in those sealed steel coffins. As the morning sky lightened, the steam arose from the convoy, from all the radiators that had been hit. The convoy commander and a hillman scurried along the line of trucks like a sheepdog yapping at his flock, shouting at his drivers to stop closing up on each other, but they ignored him, and soon the tail end of the convoy pressed forward until the gap between the trucks was cut to a few yards, offering the Arabs a neat, compact target. The first vehicle to get to the front that could still be moved crawled up to the blockade runner to get its crew. The five men managed to slip from their overturned vehicle and sprint to the car. Then they slowly moved to the second truck, which was lying on its side, the door of its armor-plated cab shut. From the bottom of the door, a thin, dark stream of blood was streaming onto the pavement. Its van was on fire, and the flames were working their way towards the cab and the gas tank behind it. Lieutenant Mashi Rasquez shouted at the truck's two drivers to open the door. There was no answer. "They're dead," someone said. Then, as his armored car started to draw away, Rasquez saw the doorknob of the cab move. Two of his men in his car slipped out the emergency door and crawled to the truck, while the Arabs sent a stream of fire down on them. They struggled to open the door. "Someone's trapped inside," one of them shouted. Rasquez saw the horror and the frustration on their faces as they tugged at the jammed door. Below the cab, a little maroon trickle continued to drop onto the pavement. The fire grew stronger, reaching out for the edges of the gas tank. Finally, Rasquez ordered his two men to flee the flames. Horror-stricken, everyone in his car stared at the overturned truck. The thin stream of blood continued to seep onto the pavement. Once again, almost imperceptibly, the doorknob moved. Then the fire reached the gas tank, and the cab was engulfed in orange flames. By now, the convoy was hopelessly stuck. Half a dozen trucks had tumbled into the gully trying to turn around. The roadblock and the two vehicles up against it eliminated any chance of going forward. Swarms of villagers, alerted by the gunfire, now covered the hillsides around the trapped convoy. As the trucks that could move began to roll back down the incline in reverse, most of them with their tires shot out, riding on their rims. The armored cars covered their withdrawal, pushing the trucks that couldn't move into the gully to clear the road. The Arabs swarmed down on the hillside, shrieking their jubilant cries of victory. They flung themselves on their prize, stripping of everything they could carry and burning what was left. For the first time, a convoy had completely failed to reach Jerusalem. There's a tremendous amount of information that I'd like to present, and I've decided that I think this is a good place because the hour's getting late. I'm going to make this into two presentations. So at this time, I'm going to stop at that point, and probably in about 2 weeks, I'm going to present the conclusion to this. I thank you for your time.
For the many blessings that Thou has given us, for Your watch care, Your protection, for the prayers Thou has answered. We're thankful, Father, to have been here this night to separate ourselves from the world for a short time. We're thankful, Father, for the information that we've received and hope that it gives us understanding and a better knowledge of our Jewish brothers and sisters. I pray, Father, for the sick and the afflicted, that Thy Spirit would be poured out upon them. I pray, Father, for Sherry and her family, that Thy Spirit would rest upon them to bring them peace and comfort in their time of need. Father, as we would go our separate ways, I do ask that thy spirit would keep us safe from harm and danger, that thou would keep us in thy care until we meet again. I'd ask it in the name of Christ. Amen.